Hi, my name is Nigel Fellows-Freeman. I am the host of Building Tomorrow's Insurer and the founder and CEO of Canopy. And I could not be more excited to welcome a very special guest here today. She has been blazing the trail since a very early age in the insurance industry. I am super excited for the conversation. I'm super excited to hear some of the stories that I've heard a few of over time that I'm keen to dig a little deeper into. And so, Sam White, thank you for joining us. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you for having me on. I'm slightly nervous now of which stories you've heard, Nigel, but I'm going to flow with it. I have no secrets.
Perfect. Well, I've obviously done a little bit of digging, but I actually only came across you just a few months ago. I was in the audience at InsurTech Australia when you flew over and did a keynote speech there. And I was really struck by your presence, by your passion, by your mission. And so I'm super grateful to have the opportunity to chat. And it was, in fact, I used your Robbie Williams story to reach out to you to get you on this pod today. And so I think that is like the perfect way to bring in just a touch of what Sam White's about. And so I'd love you to bring that story to life for everyone in terms of Robbie and your wedding. Please tell us more.
God, we're launching straight in with Robbie Williams, eh? We're starting high, Nige. We're starting
straight in.
High. I talked about it a lot that day. I love business. I've had my own business since I was 24, but I consider that business also has to weave into your life, and it has to, for me personally, it has to bring a bit of adventure and a bit of fun into life. Otherwise, I'm not doing it. I don't understand why people make things so miserable for themselves. I've got incredibly wealthy friends who make a lot of money and hate what they do, and they do it for like 14 hours a day, and it's a grind, and they don't like the people they work with and all that sort of stuff. And it just, for me, that makes no sense. So I'm giving this as backstory because people listening may be, how the hell did you end up living in Beverly Hills? But I ended up living in Beverly Hills on a bit of a whim and a bit of an adventure in 2010. I'd built up some very successful businesses in the UK. They were turning over a decent amount of money. I obviously thought that the logical next step was for me to go and try and conquer the States with limited success, but a lot of fun. And I hired a house on this estate called Mulholland Estates. And a few doors down happened to be Robbie Williams. And I was getting married and I wanted to do something special. And I'm a bit of an incurable romantic. And everything I was thinking of just wasn't quite hitting the mark. And then I just thought, you know what? Fuck it. You don't get if you don't ask. And so I wrote a letter to Robbie and said, look, I'm getting married on this day. And it was like pour your heart out time, 3 pages as to why I felt it would be just an incredible thing if he was happy to kind of have this little mini adventure with me. And I wrote him this letter and popped it through his door. And a few days later, my phone started going and it was ringing. And I didn't recognize the number. And I don't know about you, but I do not answer the phone if I don't recognize the number because it might be somebody trying to sell me something. And so I ignore it. And then they phone back and I ignore it. And they must have phoned back like 7 times. And eventually I thought maybe there's some kind of emergency. Something's happened. And I answered. And it was, in fact, Robbie Williams. And I'd forgotten I'd put the number on the bottom of the letter. And he said, I understand you're looking for a wedding singer. And I my first thought was, oh no, we've already sorted that. Like we've got the wedding singer. And then I suddenly realized, oh my God, it's Robbie Williams. So anyway, he is like me. He's a bit cheeky, loves a bit of an adventure. He agreed to it. And he, very kindly rocked up on my wedding day. I didn't tell anybody that he was coming. And so I had to sneak him into the house and hide him in the back. And then at the appropriate point, I went back and said, I'm just going to go and get the gifts for the bridesmaids, and went and grabbed Robbie and brought him out. So that was my Robbie story.
Absolutely love it. It's just, I guess, I think the shout it to me was maybe a bit of a theme in terms of what I was kind of looking a little about your kind of history around how you got to where you are. And that's a bit of audacity, trying, not being fearful of rejection or saying no. I know you are even trying to get a bank loan when you were very young and walking your dad in. I think there's so many stories of you kind of pushing that boundary. I think that's just like the epitome of that, why I really, really liked it. And I know that you've got the real thirst for cars. And in fact, I saw that you used to own a Morris Minor, and I grew up obviously in the UK, and my dad still has a Morris Minor and a Morris Minor Traveller that he's both done up both, that he's pride and joy that sit in his garage. I even saw him picked up an MG actually, which I appreciate. But like, why cars, and how was cars a fall into insurance? Was it like you couldn't get, like, talk me how that kind of happened. How did you kind of have a love of cars and then find yourself in insurance?
Yeah, so both of my parents were car nuts. My mum probably more than my dad. She had like an E-Type V12 Jaguar. She had an Alfa Romeo, Sunbeam Tiger. Like, we had loads of these really cool old classic cars. And so I was around them a lot as a kid. And there's actually a picture of me and about 15 kids in a Morgan with my dad when I'm 8 years old, because nobody gave a damn about seat belts at that point or like any kind of health and safety. And so I inherited like £1,500 from my granddad when he died. And my dad said, you can do whatever you want with it. Like, you can invest it, you can put it in the bank, you know, what do you want to do with it? And I decided I wanted to buy a car because I'd been watching, ironically enough, I'd been watching Neighbours. And you remember Charlene, Kylie Minogue, the character?
I do remember Charlene well, yeah.
I wanted to be Charlene, and the whole mechanic thing and what have you, that was like a big thing for me. So I'd got into my head that was, you know, that was who I was going to be. And so I bought, my first car I bought was a Triumph Spitfire. And I did it up in the garage with my dad. I ended up doing a BTEC in motor vehicle technology as like one of my side GCSEs. And so I learned a little bit of my way around the cars, did this car up. And actually, ironically, I couldn't insure it when I got to 17 because it wasn't quite old enough. So classic cars, normally you can get some really decent insurance deals on. But my classic car wasn't old enough for me to do that. So I sold it and I made a profit on it. And I used that to buy the Morris Minor. But I think that kind of enthusiasm and passion was in my blood. And the minute I started making money, I went out and I went through every single expensive car you can imagine that I'd had a desire for. I had a picture of, I don't know, an RX-7, you know, the rotary engined RX-7. Looks a bit like the Batmobile.
Yeah.
I saw one on a road when I was about 15 and I was like, oh my God, what is that? I have to have one of them. And I carried a picture of that car around in my wallet until I eventually bought it when I was 19. And I remember my boyfriend at the time was really aggrieved by the fact that I had a photo of the car in the wallet and not a picture of him.
But not him.
Yeah.
Show where your heart really was, eh? Show where your heart really was.
Yeah.
And how did that passion translate to insurance, right? Like, because you started early, right? You started young, you started that first business, early 20s. And so I'm interested in that founding story. Like, was it painful? Was it an opportunity? What was that thing that went, actually, let's start this claims business?
Yeah, so I did a psychology degree at university, but I had to leave. I had some challenging family circumstances, which I've always been pretty honest about. My mum had addiction issues, and that started to really spiral in my teenage years and kind of hit a bit of a crescendo in my early 20s. And it meant that I couldn't stay at home any longer. And so I needed to go out and get a job. And I saw a job advert for this motor claims business. I knew nothing, obviously, about claims, but I knew about motors, and the salary was good, and they offered to sales train you and what have you. So I was like, you know what, I'll do it. And I got this job, and I did really well with it. It was, and there was a couple of things about it. I love people. Like, I've always loved people. I'm interested in their stories, and I like connecting and learning. And this job enabled me to do that. And it started just over the phone, and I did really well, and I got promoted. And then they put me into field sales, and I did well there. And then by the time I was 23, I was earning 50 odd grand a year, which was a lot, you know, for a 23-year-old at that period of time. Not company car. I was like taking all my mates out to the pub at the weekend. And I was national accounts manager. You know, but I was not in a good space. So I was 5 stone overweight. I was smoking, I was drinking. And then 3 things happened in quick succession. I broke my leg when I was having a water fight at 3 o'clock in the morning, drunk with some friends, male friends. Girls don't do that stuff. This is why having male friends at a young age is not a good idea. I then broke up with my boyfriend, as eventually I was to end up dating and then marrying women. That probably speaks for itself. And then my mum died. The addiction got the better of her, and she overdosed when I was 23. And I just had this epiphany of that life is very short, and if you're not really careful, things can get away from you, and you can end up just doing things that you don't enjoy, that don't serve you. And, you know, so I just said I wanted to do something different. And to be honest, I didn't have a clear vision. I was 24. I just knew I didn't want to work for somebody else. I wanted to sort myself out, get my health under control. And I just kind of had this real burning desire for independence. So I would do anything at that point in terms of just hustling to make appointments and engage. But I had the experience in claims, and that was the thing that I started with and started to build from.
I love it. And it's, I think the claims industry is really the kind of what the insurance industry is all about, almost. Because that's really kind of when that kind of moment of need is. And so I think you must learn a bunch at that point, because that's really tells you everything that kind of customers need, right? You kind of learn exactly what a customer needs and how they feel. And in that kind of exact moment of, trauma, I suppose, you're there kind of support it. And I think that's the really positive part of the industry that's often forgotten or missed is that kind of is there to support folks when they have a pretty rough time. And so yeah, it's interesting you started there. And but like taking that, translating that forwards and kind of maybe fast forwarding a little bit to today in terms of Stella. And I'm sure that's a kind of culmination of a bunch of things you've had that's kind of your career to date has taken you towards, right? And so kind of maybe just interested in the kind of where it came from, how you kind of you took the kind of left right brain, that guys, I love this. Like, I'd love to, you could talk a little bit around that and give the listeners a little bit of a sense of how you came to Stella and the thinking behind it.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm 48 now, so it's 24 years I've been kicking around the industry, and I try and be as honest as possible in that I've had a great 24 years, loads of adventures, met lots of interesting people, and managed to build some successful businesses. But being female in such a male-dominated industry, does present its own challenges, and I've pretty much gone through all of them at different points. And I'm a very confident, bullish woman. So, I can go, well, if I've had that experience, how bad's it been for everybody else? Because, you know, if that's been, you know, where I've hit these walls, and there's only a penny in every pound goes to female founders in investment. That's a fact. And, you know, whenever I tried to get bank loans or bank support or anything over the years, I would always get knocked back. And it made me very, very resilient, because I, you know, if things are handed to you, you probably don't learn how to be really innovative and find solutions and, you know, do things differently. But it was tough going. So, I had that experience. I had the experience every event I went to, I'd be the only woman there. And, you know, by and large, the guys in the industry are great, and they're, you know, they're good people. And I think they are respectful of women, but there is a proportion that aren't. And, you know, I had wildly inappropriate sexual advances from business partners, from, you know, just people that you would come across in the industry on a general basis. And whenever I say that, and I've said it a few times, you know, when I've been talking publicly, I always get a raft of women will come up to me afterwards and say, thank you for saying it out loud. And I think it's hard when you are in something to really see it for what it is and really understand the experience that people have. But even something not as extreme as that, my view is insurance is, because it's so male dominated, and I say left and right brain, although I've been pulled up for that because apparently the brain scientists are saying it's not left and right anymore. So, but if you just go masculine, feminine, and actually both men and women can have masculine and feminine sides to their characters. I've got my best friends are male, and they're very in touch with their feminine side. But I think financial services is not in touch with its feminine side. And it's very analytical. It's KPI driven, which is that sort of masculine grow at any cost, more, 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 bigger, bigger, you know, that type of thinking. And because it's looking at things from a numbers perspective, what unfortunately happens is there's a real tendency to just perpetuate what you've done before, because you have the numbers for the things that you've already done. There's a security and a safety net in selling motor insurance or home insurance, because you've got all this history that has come before it with all of these numbers. So if numbers are where you're at and numbers are where your focus is, you are going to repeat everything that you've done before. You're also going to create a working environment that isn't particularly human friendly. Like I think that emotional side of our nature is the best of us. It's the bit that I'm here for. I had a gang of lads that I was friends with as a teenager. And whenever they had some kind of emotional crisis, they would end up on my doorstep. They wouldn't end up with their male friends. And I literally, there's times where I'd open the front door and one of them would just burst into tears. I'd be like, it's okay. I get like girlfriend split up with them. I had a row with the parents, you know, all of that sort of stuff. And men don't tend to do that with each other unless they're in a really, really safe environment. And financial services doesn't give them that safe environment. It tells them that what they need to be focusing on is the numbers and the KPIs, and you've got to be the best and you've got to beat everybody else. And so that environment, one, women just, it's a massive turn off. So you want to know why women aren't attracted to the industry from a job viewpoint. And a lot of times I sit in rooms and they go, we just don't understand it. Nobody's applying for a job. And I'm like, you have no idea how horrific this is, like, because they don't understand, like, this does not appeal to women. They're out, they're gone. And so, you know, from my perspective, launching Stella was on a multitude of different bases. I was saying, right, well, if this is the industry, how likely is it that they are not thinking about products from a female perspective? How likely is it that they're not getting the right talent into their businesses to do that? And if we started to design just on that very simple basis, it's 50% of the population, they make 80% of the consumer decisions. If we started to say, okay, what do women want? And are they seeing it in the products that we're developing? What would that look like? And that was kind of the birth of Stella.
And how do you think it's leveling the playing field? Like taking those points you've just made, which I think bang on the money around constructing the product and that being like this, the core thing that sits behind everything, right? You can kind of have everything that sits on the front in terms of branding and positioning and all those things. But really the thing that sits at the back is the product, which is the meaningful thing, right? And so can you talk to me a little bit about that, around how like you spoke a little bit about that, but how you're leveling the field for women with the product construct you're putting together?
Yeah, and look, we're at the start of a very, very long journey. So there is so much stuff that we want to tackle and get involved with. On the motor product, we did a lot of research to start with. So we said, okay, what it isn't working for women. And for instance, in Australia, they've tackled this in the UK, but the loyalty tax is still allowable. So you can charge people more for a renewal piece of business than you can for new business. Women hate that. Loyalty is a much bigger trigger for women than it is for men. We won't get into the ramifications of that in other areas of people's lives, but it's a big trigger for them. So we removed that. We said we won't ever offer a cheaper quote in new business than we do for the same risk at renewal. We realized that there wasn't enough cover for the contents that women tend to have. Even like my general manager, Renee, will say a pram costs more than a house. I mean, I'm sure it doesn't, but, you know, they're expensive. And a lot of the baby...
Close to.
They are so expensive. A lot of the baby accoutrements weren't covered because it just hadn't been considered in the policy. So we added that in. Then there was more philosophical issues. So we discovered that most policies, if somebody damages your vehicle that is known to you, they'll repudiate the claim. And the problem with that is domestic abuse is largely something that is suffered by women. Men do suffer with it as well, but it's disproportionately women. And often when they are abused, the abuser will also damage their property. So you end up with this double whammy that maybe they've been through that situation and then their vehicle gets damaged by this individual and then the claim's repudiated. So we wanted to remove that clause from the policy. We give $5 from every policy that we sell to Women and Girls Emergency Centre. We've given over $100,000 in Australia to them today, which we're super proud of. You know, it's not millions, but considering the fact that we're a startup, we still haven't done our first raise. We're not making money, but this was something that we wanted to show women. When we say we're with you, we're with you, and we're with you at the hardest possible period of time that you could experience. And then we took that and we said, how could we combine those two things, insurance and this very real need that we can see is out there? And we've just started, we've designed it. We're just working out the deployment mechanisms, but we designed the first ever domestic abuse insurance because, again, this idea that you could create a policy that would solve a real world problem. So that is being embedded in the motor insurance policy. And then if any of our policy holders are a victim of domestic abuse, they can get access to funds and get out. And it's just the start for me. I just discovered literally a couple of weeks ago that most health insurance policies don't have any coverage for the menopause, which is insane. 20% of the population is menopausal. You cannot see it in any of the policy documents that are out there because, No disrespect, they've been designed by men. Men are terrified of the menopause. Most women don't like to talk about the menopause. So you've just got this whole chasm, this black hole. And our thing as well is, okay, there's product design, there's changes there, there's that commitment to the wider community, but there's also that education piece, that conversation. We don't talk about insurance at all to our policyholders because nobody wants to talk about insurance. We talk about the things that are important to them. So we've partnered with Generation M, which is a menopausal purpose-driven business that's helping brands understand the menopause and how they can design products to help support them. And then we can share that content with our policyholders and say, you know, watch out for this. Because, you know, practically speaking, from an actuarial viewpoint, they'll say women become a worse risk from the ages of, 50 to, and of course, it's during the menopause, you've got brain fog, you've got, you know, heightened emotions. So it starts to then weave into, can we help? Like, can we help stop the thing being a problem in the first place? But it's, you know, it's conversations that really insurers probably haven't traditionally engaged with, and certainly not from a female perspective.
No, totally. And I think, yeah, the wordings is such an interesting thing. Obviously, many a night kind of read through a bunch of different wordings, and we're doing a product at the moment, and it's this wording's been carried over for must have been years, and it's got about hovercrafts in it. It's a business policy, and it's got hovercrafts in it. I spoke to the carrier and I was like, what on earth is this? And they're like, it's just in there. It's just been in there for years. And I was like, well, that doesn't mean it should stay in there just because it's been in there years. Like, absolutely bananas.
I know we'll find so much more. So what we're on a raise at the moment to get in product designers, but one of the roles that I want is somebody to just sit and go through exactly that, because I will guarantee that there are some, you know, up until 1976, I think certainly in the UK law, there was still that inference that women belonged to their husband. And I am sure that buried deep in the heart of some of these policy wordings, there'll be some crap that you really don't want to have in there. But and then, you know, it's not just insurance, financial services, delinquency rates on female loans are so much lower because there's a sense of responsibility that women tend to have that is not as prevalent in men. They don't get cheaper interest rates though on their loans. They should. It's, you know, if you actually looked at it from a,
if you actually apply the data, don't take a narrow view to the data, but actually look at the data and write it accordingly. I think you're bang on. And like you touched on there, more generally financial services, like do you have a view to spread from insurance with Stella, like across different financial services? Is that a vision for the business, or is it kind of an insurance business at its core?
I am coming for it all. So, you know, absolutely. We want Stella to be the brand for women in financial services, and we're betting on the fact that, you know, because we will do it so authentically, because we will do it coming from the right place with the right actions and behaviors, that over time we will build up such a trust with women that they will know that if we've moved into a sector, we've made sure that it's fair and balanced for them, and we're doing some good with it.
It's kind of interesting like that. It kind of reminds me a little bit of the Virgin brand, and not in terms of how it's appropriated, but just in terms of the brand and how it's been delivered across so many different sectors. And it's, I guess, what the brand stands for that people go to those businesses for. Is that something you kind of struck me there when I was listening to you? Is that something you, I guess, aspire to, but kind of maybe kind of as an inspiration for kind of how you think about things?
Yeah, I mean, I've watched, I don't know, I do a lot of transatlantic flights. So I watched the Branson documentary, and he's somebody that evokes a lot of feelings both ways, doesn't he?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah, that's what I mean. That's why I called it out. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know what? One of the things that, and I know a few people that have worked with him, and one of the things that I do really respect about him as an entrepreneur is that he is happy to hire professional people in a given sector and allow them to run the businesses, which allows him the ability to span across lots of different areas. Yeah. And yeah, I'm sure he's got some things wrong, but he's got a lot of things right. And he was an entrepreneur of his of his generation. I think for me, our purpose as a business is incredibly clear. So there will be businesses that it doesn't make sense for us to engage in. So if there's no way that we can make it better from a female perspective, we wouldn't be interested in engaging with that. I don't want to sell bananas. I can't see how that would be.
No, you don't. Fair. Is there any women that you was there any women that you that were aspirational for you that you're inspired by? Like, are there any figures or any kind of who?
And it's so, again, how we talk about female entrepreneurs, we tend to, there's some incredible female entrepreneurs that aren't held up as female entrepreneurs. So Oprah Winfrey. I absolutely love that woman. She's astounding. And I watched the Light Within Us, and it was her and Michelle Obama chatting on stage, and it was just absolutely magic. But she's an incredible example of an entrepreneur, but we think of her as a TV show host. And, you know, there's
so much more.
There's a lot wrong with our culture in how we like to categorize women. And as a result of that, most young girls, if asked who, you know, their image of an entrepreneur, it's always a male figure. They don't see women in that way. And if they don't see it, then they don't think that they could potentially be it in the future. So it's, I'm passionate about that as well. Maya Angelou, I've just finished listening to Letters to My Daughter. The life that she had, the traumas that she went through, and the absolute elegance and grace with which she handled herself. I mean, I'm Northern and a bit sweary, so I don't think, you know, I can aspire to these women. But I respect people that can handle adversity and not let it infect them and make them become bitter. You know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, same thing. She tackled the law, one law at a time, from an equality viewpoint. She never lost her humor. She never let herself kind of sink into being vindictive or resentful. And I think that those are all qualities that I absolutely admire and respect.
If you could go back to your younger self as now a woman that would aspire to be and aspire, like, look up to you, what would you maybe tell those folks, those young women that are starting out, or even yourself? You're one of those young women starting out in your career or in life, doesn't not necessarily career. Like, what advice would you give?
I think it takes longer for women to trust themselves than it does men. And I was no different. I think we are taught to second guess ourselves. And most women that I know suffer with a much higher level of imposter syndrome and insecurity than most men that I know. So I think, and I am fortunate enough to be able to engage with a number of much younger female entrepreneurs now and be able to have these conversations and kind of hopefully get them there quicker than it took me. But I think trusting yourself and not allowing people to convince you that they know better than you just because they're older or they've been in a sector for a longer period of time. That's like the amount of times I've been hoodwinked by somebody who overcomplicated the shit out of something that was actually very simple. And me believing that their overcomplication meant that they knew something that I didn't know is a critical factor, because when it all unpicked and you looked at it, it was like, nah, that you knew what was the right thing from the get-go, but you just didn't trust yourself.
Yeah, super interesting. I want to switch gears a little bit. I want to switch gears into more the general insurance sector, trends, what's coming. And what you just mentioned there, I thought was really interesting, which was overcomplication. And I actually came from outside the industry, and that forced me to take a bit of a kind of first principle approach, because you don't know what you don't know, and therefore you kind of make decisions based on what you think is logical and right. And that kind of has really helped us with the technology that we've built, I think. But how do you think about that in terms of technology more broadly across insurance, like where it is today, and kind of how kind of the technology needs to kind of assist and enable the insurance sector, like a broad theme? How do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some incredible technology available now that could genuinely revolutionize the experience for consumers and make the industry far, far better. I don't think we have an issue with technology. I think we have an issue with cultural resistance. I think this all comes down, and it comes back to my masculine thinking, male dominated, very fixed. This is the data that I have. This is the information. I cannot cope if I don't have this information in this format, in this way. And what I've witnessed is huge blockers to actually doing the right thing, getting the right result, that comes from a absolute resistance to change and a resistance to doing something even remotely different to what they've done before. So it's hard, because we still have this problem, I think, that the insurtech industry has taken a hammering over the last 12 months. And you had these insurtechs that came in with absolutely the right approach to go, what does good look like from the consumer viewpoint? How am I going to make this experience work from a consumer viewpoint? But you can't do that because you need the industry. Insurance, it does require a huge volume of capital that has structures in it and agreed ways of working that can't stay the same and then engage with this new technology. So trying to build a bridge between those two things is a constant challenge for me. I own my own tech stack. We bought the tech company that built our platform for us originally, but we are constantly walking that balance between using the existing ecosystem and making sure that the existing ecosystem is happy and being able to deploy the right technological solution. And I think the answer is that you have to work so hard on the communication piece. And I'm very direct, and so I probably find it a bit easier if I'm in a meeting and it's the unspoken stuff that kills you. So you go into a meeting and
the gray.
And you're talking and everyone's sat quietly, and then you know that they're going to leave that meeting and go and have another meeting where they say all the reasons why your thing can't go forward and it can't work. And like the meeting that screws you is not the meeting that you're having with them. It's the meeting that they have. And I will call that out, and I will push really hard to, I had it a couple of days ago. My team was on a call with another team, and they came back and they went, Sam, they were so defensive and, you know, really guarded. And I said, let me pick up the phone. And I phoned the principal and just said, this was the experience of my team. What don't we know? Like, why are they feeling like this? Why are they so guarded? And he told me why. And I was like, oh, okay, we can fix that. Like, that's fine. But people
won't. We can fix that.
We can fix that. But people won't tell you. So you have to, if it feels wrong, if the engagement feels wrong in any aspect of your life, personal, work, whatever, then it probably is wrong. And you need to find out why. And you just need to keep prodding until people tell you what the actual objection is.
In terms of what you mentioned there, which is kind of the value chain, I suppose, and the culture, the people and the processes to be able to do things differently at any point in that value chain needs everyone, needs the reinsurers, need the carriers, need the technology partners, need the distributors. Everyone needs to kind of be aligned, right? And I think if I reflect on when we've done like technology implementations that have been great, and ones that have never, that have not worked, it's always because there isn't a joint understanding and belief in what you're doing.
Absolutely.
Because maybe there's different stakeholders. As soon as you're not on exactly all aligned and have a real clarity and transparency across actually what you're trying to do, they've always failed. They've always fallen over.
And it's, you know, what I find really interesting, and this is one of the things that it's been my approach, and I've been told it's the wrong approach, and I've gone back and forth with, is, same, you know, in personal relationships, one of you has to make the first move. One of you has to be prepared to be vulnerable and transparent in order for the other one to feel safe enough to do that. And I'm happy to be that person. Like, we are taught in business to hold your cards close to your chest. If you, you know, if you're transparent with people, they will take advantage. But as somebody once said to me, people don't take advantage, you give advantage. So just because I'm transparent doesn't mean that you can just have whatever you want. Like, you know, but if I want to get to a deal that actually does work for all parties, then and we all need to see everything as it is, not just the little parts that you choose to show. So I think, like, taking that first step and being prepared to be completely open and transparent is where it has to start from. And these companies are not taught to do that, and it does go back to that lack of emotional intimacy that you have in the teams, because we're not leading enough from our hearts. We're spending too much time in our head and discussing numbers, and so even within their own teams they don't trust each other. So to try and get them to trust a team that's outside of their team, like, blows your brain.
Yeah, the too hard basket very quickly.
Yeah.
You guys are doing some, I think I saw you guys doing some telematics. Is that right? You guys doing some telematics in the UK?
So that's my old business.
Interesting to kind of hear it. Your old business, is it? Sorry.
I've still got that business. And I would love to do some telematics in Stella.
Yeah. And it's have you found getting carrier support for it's been difficult? Have you found that there's, like, have you found any barriers to kind of underwriters being comfortable with it? Like, how have you seen it? Because we've seen some, like, Italy seems to be getting some traction and doing some really good things. There's a little bit in the UK. Australia's been pretty behind. We haven't really done much here at all. Like, I think it seems to be maybe more by the mile versus driving behavior. Just kind of really interested to hear kind of how you found it and what you think about the future of it.
Yeah, I love telematics. I cannot understand why the insurance industry doesn't engage more with it. We're asking all of these questions, which are proxies, to try and discover one thing. Are you a good driver? It just blows my mind. We built up a business of over 40 million in premium, all 80% over 30-year-olds. And the driving score that we had was so predictive for loss ratio, it wasn't even funny. So if they had a driving score of 65 or above, then they would sit on that lower quartile all day long from a loss ratio perspective. So you go tick, 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 like, but every box ticked, even the age group, which was a challenge in the initial instance. And we had a capacity provider pull out of the market kind of unexpectedly, because we thought they'd got a longer term strategy. And we have a devil of a job trying to get other carriers to look at it, because it's something new. And because traditionally they have had problems with the young driver market with telematics. So UK here, your big problem is obviously catastrophic claims, the cost of XOL, and they got quite badly hurt with people not not using the data. Like, they just put a box in the car and just put a discount on and make some money out of it. But of course, they become very linear in their thinking. Telematics is bad. And then it switched off. And they all, like a swarm, just go in that direction where they go, that's a bad thing, we don't do that. And I'm like, how could you not want this? You even surely your masculine left brain side is super excited by the level of data that you would get from telematics. But yeah, insane. I mean, there's so much stuff you can do with it. And, you know, helping actually make people safer.
Yeah, exactly right. That kind of proactive piece is really interesting, right? And the data is only as good as you use it. And so you can pull all the telematic data out as you want. But if the kind of models that are sitting behind it, that are writing the products, are still old models that don't take these kind of data points into account, then you're going to write bad risk and you're going to have really unprofitable books. And so kind of this disconnect, right, which has kind of led to this, I think, and from what I see, has led to a bunch of like people walking away, but actually the implementation has been really poor, which has kind of led to the dismay. What do you think about the impact of autonomous? Obviously it's in the, like, I feel like it's a fair way away. Like, it's not, I don't know, next decade, maybe the decade after. Probably people will challenge me on that, I think, but I think things always take a little longer than you believe, especially when you think the average car is 15 years old and et cetera, et cetera. What do you think about the impact of autonomous vehicles on the industry?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen a lot of stuff around this, because, you know, there's a thought process that the policy will change to be more of a cyber risk than the standard policy that we have now. I have a non-exec that talks far more eloquently on this, guy called David Williams, who was at AXA for a number of years. You should definitely get him on to have a chat, because he's super well informed.
But well.
There's the moral question with autonomous vehicles, which they always keep reverting to, which is, you know, if the computer knows that swerving to avoid an accident, you're as the driver going to die, but that you're going to save the lives of the people in the car that is coming towards you, then how do you underwrite that risk, and would anybody get in the car, knowing that the car's main priority is to mitigate risk for everybody else and not necessarily you. So there's a view that fully autonomous would never happen because they can't, they just can't get past that, that one kind of trigger point as to who's responsible. And also I think there's some issues with, in order for it to be fully autonomous, the traffic systems and the mapping system also has to be able to align fully with it. I think what we'll end up with is a hybrid where we'll have a lot less claims. And you would hope that that would then bring down the cost of insurance. But what we've seen over the last 10 years is the cost of repairs has gone through the roof because all of this new technology is really expensive to replace and deal with. And so actually there may be less claims, but they're costing more money. And so we still end up in a situation that the insurance is not cheap.
If you were going to try and paint a picture of the future insurer, call it 20 years time, what do you think that kind of future insurer looks like? Maybe a, like a Stellar example or a Carrier example, like just interesting you seeing how you think that that looks and feels in 20 years time.
Yeah, I mean, eventually we've got to catch up, right? Like eventually we have to catch up with all the other industries, the Amazons, the Ubers, the, you know, the things that we use that we really like using because it's dead easy. And I guess that comes down to doing what, where we're going with AI is we're doing the thinking for people. So a future insurer would come to you and be able to say, can you give me access to you? And you would then, they would then be able to scan all aspects of your life and statistics and everything else and suggest, these are the risks that I think you are exposed to, and these are the potential policies that we can give you to cover that off. And you choose which bits you want and which bits you don't, but we can give you that holistic package. I mean, I saw a piece of technology that was able to plug into your Wi-Fi and through that, see what devices you have in your house and then compare those devices to the policy that you had to be able to go, actually, have you got, you know, is your contents cover only 100 grand? And I can already tell from your Wi-Fi connections, you've got £500,000 worth of equipment, or have you got cover that you don't need? Because I can see your policy wordings doubling up on in these areas and you've already got it covered on your equipment. So I think for me, it's around that flexibility, that choice, and that ease of purchase. What consumers are used to now and expecting more of is us to do the thinking for them and tell them what it is that they potentially need. And I don't think we've done that very well in insurance today.
No, you just mentioned Amazon, and that just triggered a thought. I think they just bought a company which is everyone thought it was quite strange that they bought a vacuum cleaner business, which was like kind of the autonomous vacuum cleaners going around your home. But like there's a bunch of underlying thinking around about kind of like mapping the house, and so actually the vacuum kind of goes around the home, maps the home, sees what's exactly in the house. Kind of, it gets a really great picture of data. So it's more of a data play than actually wanting to kind of get into the industry. And I think that speaks exactly to what you're saying, which is the more information, the more data you have, the more kind of you can predict and prevent things happening. And I think that's maybe the way the industry needs to translate over time. We are so nearly there, Sam. This has been so great. But I would really like maybe just to kind of wrap and maybe kind of give an opportunity to really talk about, share your vision of the future of Stellar. Like, I'd love to maybe end on that, because I think, I know the listeners would love to hear it. I'm sure you'd like to tell us. And so, yeah, please, can you share that vision of Stellar over the next kind of few years?
Yeah, so I mean, for us, we are on an absolute mission, and the whole team is behind that. My general manager is actually moving her entire family to the UK to take that next kind of step. She's replaced herself in Sydney, and you know, she's coming over here to work with me as the chief operations officer and help us move forward. Stella's going to be a global brand for financial services. What we want to do is genuinely get into every single product where we feel that women won't have been considered, the product won't be fit for purpose, and redesign it from a female perspective so that they can have what they deserve. They should have menopause cover in their health insurance, for Christ's sake. Like that should be there. But we also want to be an integration point between other women and financial services. So we've partnered already with a raft of female-based communities. We Are One Roof in Australia, Enterprise Vision Awards and Northern Power Women in the UK are all female entrepreneur platforms. And the beauty about that, we go back to that collaboration and communication, is we're already having forums with these women and saying, what, you know, your business owners, what don't you get at the moment from financial services that you would like to have? And there's, again, there's a whole raft. We mentioned about loans and you know, why can they not get funding? And when they do get funding, why aren't they getting a lower interest rate based on actually performative data around women? So for us, the plan is global across a whole spectrum of financial services products. We do have this social purpose. So any product that we launch will have a give back, which is around issues that we think are important to women, whether that be domestic abuse, or, you know, we decided to partner with a local children's charity here in the north of England that helps underprivileged kids have a safe space to go to and kind of have a little bit of hope for the future. And we've said, you know, when we launch the home product, that they'll be the partner for them. So it really goes beyond just building a good insurance business or a good financial services business, or building a brand that women recognize to be for them and about them. For us, it's also about saying, can we build businesses that work for everybody and not just for the shareholders? Can we make something that actually feels a lot fairer and a lot better on a general basis? So not much then, Nigel. not much to tackle, but the team seems up for it, so we're going to give it a good go.
Sam, thank you so much. It's been an absolute blast. I've really enjoyed the conversation. I have really enjoyed listening to your stories, and it continues to inspire me, and I'm sure it's inspiring a bunch of folks listening. And so thank you for everything you're doing for women, for the industry, and keep doing what you're doing. We'll be cheering from the sidelines, and make sure that you look us up next time you're down in Australia. We'd love to say hi and go out and grab a coffee.
Yeah, sounds good.
Thanks so much, Sam.